session number 30304.
Said Rayner, reel 25.
After the raid, we left for the return to Silith, saddened by the news that the CO and his crew had not returned from the raid. And we discovered later, of course, after the war, in fact, that after dropping their bombs on the target at Bremen, they were crossing the Dutch coast at 800 feet on their way home. They saw an aircraft on their port bow coming in the opposite direction at the same height. And it was an ME-110 night fighter. This was confirmed when the aircraft turned to get on his tail and Hodgkinson opened his throttles, dived for a cloud layer some 2,000 feet below. And as he was about to enter the cloud, he was hit by heavy cannon fire. And the Hudson immediately burst into flames and he headed for the sea to attempt to ditch. He couldn't leave the others in the aircraft, so he went down, and in fact, as the aircraft was really a mass of flames by this time, it helped to play a part in his survival as the flames illuminated the surface of the sea so that he could heave back on the control column just in time to make a successful ditching. And when he came to, he saw a main wheel floating nearby in a heavy sea and swam over to it, found his navigator, Flight Lieutenant Cave, clinging to it, and Cave was badly shot up. After about an hour, when hope of survival was fading, they heard a great whoosh alongside them, and up popped the main aircraft dinghy, which must have worked itself loose from the wreckage. What a coincidence! They managed to clamber in, and at dawn on the 26th, they were washed ashore on the Frisian island of Ameland, taken prisoner, and that was the end of Squadron Leader Hodgkinson's war. But we went on, and when and John Elaine and I learned, we'd be posted back to an operational squadron. We were of one mind. We would prefer an anti-shipping strike squadron to one flying patrols against U-boats. But in the usual way, we had to put our requests in writing and asked the adjutant to do a little special pleading for us, but he wasn't very good at pleading, because a few days later we had to report back to the adjutant, who briefly informed us that the first bowfighter wing being formed at Northcotes was not yet ready for operational work. And to our suggestion that it was therefore not too late to join it, his asperic reply was that they had all the pilots they needed, thank you very much. Obviously, replacements wouldn't be needed for some time. And Johnny and I said, well, we wouldn't mind waiting. We're quite enjoying what we're doing. But I fancy the adjutant was looking forward to seeing the back of us. His next words were, we'd never get any work done if everybody wanted the kind of individual attention you're hoping to get. We had almost reached the door on our way out when he called us back. By the way, I almost forgot, he continued. You are both posted to 269 Squadron in Iceland to fly Hudsons. Start your embarkation leave the day after tomorrow.
Was there any reason for your preference for an anti-shipping squadron rather than anti-U-boat squadron?
Well, first of all, the Hudson was becoming obsolescent, at least compared with the stuff which were then beginning to be supplied to Coastal Command, particularly in the anti-U-boat war. And secondly, 220 Squadron were, in fact, converting to four-engine. They went on to Fortresses as a squadron. And we, I think we enjoyed more the direct action that we had on 220 Squadron and even low-level flying when we were training than the stooging around that one had to do in protecting or trying to protect ships and well, anything down below in an anti-U-boat squadron. And also, of course, the new twin-engine stuff like the Mosquito and the Bowfighter both fitted our tastes better than the Hudson. We still revered the Hudsons. Some people didn't, but we did, those immediately concerned in a possible posting, because they've been so wonderful to us, no problems at all as far as the aircraft were concerned. But because the main area of operations against U-boats was at a much greater distance in the middle of the Atlantic than we could reach with our limited range in Hudsons, it was either, it seemed to us, either an anti-shipping squadron. We certainly didn't want to leave Coastal Command at that stage. It was either anti-shipping or four-engine stuff to get out as far as was needed in order to deal with the U-boats. So that was why we had a preference. And we were all three of us. Harry Ramsey joined us. He'd been instructing at Thornaby, which had become number six operational training unit for Coastal Command. So the three of us were old-time lags, if you like, of Hudson squadrons, which had dealt both with shipping and U-boats, and we would have, each of us preferred to have, and particularly, I think, in the case of Harry Ramsey, who had the best strike record in 220 Squadron at the time that we left, anyway. It was a disappointment, but we were still going to fly Hudsons, so we had no fears at all about the future.
Did you make any special organisation, any kind of preparations for this flight to Iceland? Were you aware of what you might need to take with you? Or?
No, because flights to Iceland were quite commonplace. Our 269 Squadron had been based there since 1941. And, of course, the major overhauls were still done in UK, most of them at places like Dyce or other maintenance units. So there were quite a lot of flights going backwards and forwards. And we obviously took what had been issued for use in cold weather in the UK and what was needed when we actually got to Iceland could be supplied from stores there. But in terms of the flight, it was a very commonplace flight to Cardedanus. What we didn't know much about was the actual airfield at Cardedanus. It wasn't easy to describe in its position about 50 miles southeast of Reykjavik. Reykjavik had the normal concrete runways, but we were going to Cardedanus, which had a sort of compressed lava as the main material for the runways. So that would be something a little novel to us.
So can you tell me about the flight and the arrival?
Yes, we approached Iceland from the southeast on an overcast and windy day, with the grey Atlantic swell looking worse than we'd ever seen it before, I think, breaking into lines of foam-topped white horses. And as we approached the ungainly humps of the Vestmannaeyjar Islands, my pronunciation may not be very good to the Icelander, but I think you'll understand that there are a few islands a few miles off the mainland coast. And we looked across to starboard for the imposing mass that we knew was there, the Mýrdalsjökull, one of the four areas of glacier-edged permanent ice and snow, which is a small one compared with the vast expanse of the Vatnajökull away to the east, but we couldn't see them because all we saw was a coastline of black lava sand and the swirling curtains of fine rain, which we were to know to even greater degree before long, covering the forbidding cliffs behind. And as we passed the offshore island of Hyme, and now flying almost parallel to the shrouded coast, in the distance the lower lava-strewn land was slowly revealed, leading to the airfield at Cardedanus, 269's squadron base. And on the circuit, I remember we looked down on a collection of small Nissen huts, their ribbed semicircular roofs giving a welcome touch of green to the dull, whether it was moss or paint, to the dull grey surroundings. And there were three larger mess huts and a rectangular corrugated iron hangar. The operations block cocooned in protective covering, and the two square towers, runway control tower and the vital electricity generating station. Well, it was obvious the runway in use will grant no favours to a misguided approach and landing, neither in its length, its lack of length, and the quality of its lava-based asphalt surface. We agreed that any aircraft larger than a Hudson would not fit this environment. Anyway, Harry produced a landing, as one might expect, the three of us were all flying up together, which was an effective demonstration of the skills the squadron could expect from its new recruits. The orderly officer took the three of us and a flying officer named Johnson, who was to be Johnny Lane's navigator, to our quarters. One of the small Nissen huts, which were shared by four officers. I dare say their descriptions are known to so many members of all the armed forces. In each corner stood the usual iron-framed bedstead with its straw palliasse, a neatly folded pile of blankets and sheets topped by a bulky pillow, and beside it the ubiquitous small cupboard-cum-bookshelf-cum-table imposing in the majesty of his isolation. In the center of the hut stood the familiar round pot-bellied, I think is a coarse name for it, coke-burning stove, reacting to every opening of the door with a welcome roar and a surge in the ruddy glow on the concrete standing. Our first requirement, of course, would be a fork to sample the toast-making propensities. Well, the construction of various buildings was continuing, and within a few days, we discovered a dump of surplus and discarded material, and a little melodramatic begging secured from the stores a quantity of nails, a loan of tools, and after the usual flying familiarization during daylight hours, by 4 o'clock and the descent of subarctic night, we began, and for 3 or 4 days continued, the conversion of our humble abode. Remember, it was an open Nissen hut. I don't mean it doesn't have a roof, and it was just you went in the door and the whole of it was revealed. But we decided we wanted something a little more private, and so the structure of the hut, although it dictated the form it would take, at each end there was a doorway, one of which we boarded up and draft-proofed with layers of brown paper from parcels, and on each side of the doorways a window. The stove in the middle had to be a shared necessity. So the plan was for the partitioning of the four quarters on a 2-inch by 3-inch wooden framework covered with plasterboard, with open access at one end to the warmth emanating from the center of the room, the wonderful stove. We even found enough assorted curtain material, believe it or not, to cover the windows, not especially for privacy, but to add another flimsy layer of insulation against the invading coal drama. One of the important duties assigned to 269 Squadron based in Iceland was to protect as far as possible and to patrol for as many as 3 Russian convoys a month. By Russian, I mean convoys either or both from UK and USA, which left Iceland as many as 3 times a month to pass to the west of the island through the Denmark Straits for most of the year, until the winter threat of pack ice necessitated a passage along the east coast, which shortened the air escort time as the 2 air bases were in the southwest corner at Reykjavik and Kaldadanas. It didn't really, movement of the convoys to the east of Iceland, rather than going up through the Denmark Straits when they could, didn't really help the convoys, because, of course, going up the east side of Iceland, they were within reach of enemy attack. Well, after working up to operational standard with my crew, Warrant Officer Cugsley, navigator, and Flight Sergeants Jackie Noble and Jackie Hollis, they were the air gunners, WAP air gunners, on only one previous sortie, the Bremen raid, had I flown with a navigator who was other than a co-pilot. And that particular experience had left several questions unanswered. But Pug, as he was known, soon removed any doubts. Straightforward fellow of blunt but genuine opinions, which had none of some of his abilities from other people. It quickly revealed his abilities.
Was there a difficulty, because obviously what you'd experienced on the Roman raid with the navigator, of you being able to think of them having the responsibility for almost flying, you know, of navigating the aircraft from one place to another, because you'd always relied on yourself on the co-pilot to do that? Was that a sort of quite a big step for you, because you had that amount of experience already?
Yes, we realised, of course, that it had been general throughout the Air Force to include a navigator in the crew for some time, but it hadn't reached us in 220 Squadron. Even after we left and until the squadron converted to fortresses, we had still flown as two pilots, or alternately flying or navigating. So I think there must have been some reaction, as between a pilot and a navigator, for anyone flying on the Bremen raid. My own, I think, was a misfortune, not realized to the same, not materializing to the same effect as it had in my case. But of course, I think I was probably the only one with a Texan from the wide open spaces who had only flown overland before, had only just arrived at Silloth on the conversion course, probably hadn't been any further over the sea than the Solway Firth. At least he had a very good reason or excuse for not being able to cope on that particular occasion. So yes, I had my doubts about flying with a navigator as to whether they could put themselves, as they needed to so frequently, into the position of the pilot, and what's he got to cope with out of where I get him, sort of where I put him. And of course, being in Iceland, there was only one really good landing ground, and that was Reykjavik, the main. There were all kinds of hazards, both from weather and from the terrain. So for me to have a Pugsley. And we had a very strong bond, so everything was okay.
What about the other crew members?
Let's see. Yes, I knew both of them, actually. Jackie Noble had been on 220 Squadron, although I hadn't flown with him, but he knew of me and I knew of him. And, of course, word gets around if he's it's good or and so on. There was no trouble, really. We very quickly became a very adequate crew.
Were you, at that stage, would you say everybody was quite experienced? Had he actually done any navigation before, or was he a new navigator?
For me?
Yeah, or with anybody else?
Well, of course, it varied. People were joining squadrons, people were leaving, and it didn't all sort of go en bloc. We three formed three crews, and three crews were leaving. I don't know who they were at that time, but they would go to Silloth, probably, or to Thornaby, to instruct or to go and fly somebody for drug towing or what was known as a rest period. Sorry, I've rather lost what the question was. He was very experienced, yes. He had actually flown to Iceland before. Shortly after the army landed in 1940, they were accompanied by a flight of Hurricane fighters, and then they were superseded by ferry battle, supposedly light bombers, but also supposedly capable of becoming fighters. And as I'd flown one, the one that we had at Silloth, I didn't think either category suited them. In fact, there's only one place really, and that was the tip. It was certainly an accolade for Pug that he had flown with 98, or was it 96, squadron in battles and navigated from, obviously, as a navigator for a period of 6 months or something like that. So, he was very experienced, and he was a pre-war boy entrant. He's the real stuff.
How long did this period of working up with your crew take, and were you doing operations at the same time?
Yes. I don't actually remember the first time we flew, because we were each of us experienced, the four of us experienced in our own categories, we were very quickly regarded as a crew. Whether we considered ourselves to be a fully operational crew or not, we were there. We had previous operational service, and therefore we were on the operational register more or less from the word go. So I don't remember the first time we would fly operationally, but it wasn't very often. Perhaps, you see, I think it was September 1942 when we the end of September 42 when we eventually reached Iceland, and the first real onerous task we had was the reconnaissance flight for checking the ice in the Denmark Straits. When there was an opportunity, whether we were down on the operational list with a particular patrol or escort to do, if we could get to the aircraft and get the aircraft for an hour or two, we would go and consolidate the crew functions, I can put it that way. I would say we were quite happy to take off as a fully fledged crew within a week or 10 days after arriving. And you see, we were on this ice reconnaissance flight, which was really the most onerous of the likely jobs we would be given in November, within 2 months of arriving on the squadron.